podcast listeners. This is Heather, and this is the Unofficial Landing Podcast. We're a cheeky little podcast, just two episodes old, but by the time you finish listening to this, our third episode, we'll all be just a little bit older, and hopefully a little bit wiser. What do you think about when you think about prostitution? Ask somebody that, and the image that they're likely to describe is one of a woman on a lonely street corner, maybe in the cold, walking back and forth. Have you ever asked yourself where you got that image, though? Tonight we talked with Sarah, who just wrapped up an enormous research project on sex worker representation in digital culture and avenues of resistance. Her prize-winning essay is described this way by its abstract, and a quick caution, there's some language you might not want younger listeners to hear. The essay, Sarah says, examines the roles of reproduction and critique in our interactions with images of sex workers in new media. It sounds simple enough, but here is where it gets interesting. Sarah goes on to say this. If we understand new media representations of sex workers as reproductions of sex worker bodies, occupied by dominant and oppositional discourses on sex workers' social positions, and ourselves as agents acting on and through the text we read, we can apply a critical methodology of fucking the production and reproduction of hegemonic narratives to begin to rewrite images of sex workers and reclaim autonomous subjectivities. As an aside, hegemonic narratives, you see, are the kind of dominant narratives, the things you hear mostly in mainstream media and the messages being produced by the so-called authorized culture of government and society. Sarah wrote about the damage these narratives can do, the way it impacts the safety surrounding the environment sex workers find themselves in. And she's not pulling her punches, as you might suspect. So she goes on to talk about the very definitions we use for sex worker and the narratives that surround them. She says, definitions are provided for sex work, post-industrial capitalism, and fucking, and a variety of new media narratives about sex work and sex workers, including police websites, news articles, YouTube videos, and pornography, all are surveyed to develop a description of dominant discourse about sex work, or getting fucked, and to propose a resistant alternative, fucking. It was a strongly worded paper, but also an example of the kinds of things students can find themselves researching. So tonight we talked more to Sarah about her research on the images of sex workers. Like it or hate it, the oldest profession is something that sex workers, men and women, are involved in. Sarah's research looked closely at the images used to depict them, and how it's often used against them.
I won the Barbara Roberts Memorial Award for research in feminism and gender studies.
Now that is pretty cool. What were you studying? I already know, but no one else does, so.
I'm bad at being interviewed. I should have won. I was visiting Athabasca as a student from New York and did a reading course on images of sex workers in digital culture. So I suppose I was studying cultural studies. It was kind of a strange project, though. So I don't have that one sentence sum up.
It's hard to come up with an elevator pitch for your research, isn't it? Because people ask me what I'm doing, and I'm like, well, I could tell you, but it's going to take half an hour.
And I could tell you about it for half an hour. I wouldn't know that. I think it's interesting.
I thought it was really interesting, too. For people that aren't aware, the research that Sarah was doing was about the portrayal of sex workers, wasn't it?
It was. It was about how sex workers are represented in these stereotyped images that appear over and over and over again.
So like your stereotypical TV image of prostitution, right?
Yeah, what Shauna Ferris describes as the lone street walker. So, and if you look through your newspaper, you start to identify this really, really quickly if there's any prostitution news. It's a lone woman. She stands on a street corner. It's dark, so you probably can't see her face, but you can see that she's a white woman. She's dressed sexy. She's displaying her body for the cars that are passing by and, of course, for the viewer, who she's seemingly unaware of through the camera. And the impression is that she's flaunting her own safety despite these dangerous conditions, and of course flaunting the neighborhood safety and not really paying any attention to how seedy and criminal it is,
mm-hmm.
while she brings the neighborhood down. So that's the image of sex workers that we see over and over and over again when it's presented on TV or when it's presented in the newspaper.
And so that kind of portrayal, what kind of effect does it have on women that are involved in that industry?
That's hard to say. I'm not sure it's something where you can announce a really simple cause and effect. But
mm-hmm.
Definitely as the image contributes to criminalization. So it gives the public an idea that having sex workers in your neighborhood, because it looks so dangerous, is a dangerous thing and it brings down your property value.
Right,
and folks get together and try to get them out of their neighborhoods. So there has been some research showing that when that happens and when they're successful in removing sex workers from their neighborhood, that sex workers experience more violence. And I don't know if you want to call it a really good example, but a really mm-hmm. forceful example of that is what happened in Vancouver when the neighborhood associations were successful in pushing women out of residential neighborhoods and into industrial neighborhoods, women started dying.
Right.
And as the laws against sex work were stiffened and it was changed from solicitation, and it had to be pressing and persistent, to any kind of communication in public at all could get a woman arrested,
mm-hmm.
then women started dying even more, or disappearing, or in various ways just not coming back.
And now we arrive at part two of our podcast. Part two, the ideal city. The ideal city, the perfect place to live, to work, to raise a family, is something that we all seem to want. Conversations about it are being had in the small towns and in large urban centers, and as we watch the Occupy protest movement in the United States, or even just the cleanup efforts in Fukushima, we're talking about just what it means to create the perfect place to live. Whatever we think it is, we want it, and we've wanted it for a long time. The ideal city goes as far back as Plato, when he wrote The Republic. But it probably goes farther back than that, because for as long as we've lived together, people have wanted to make it work. And nowadays, when we live much closer together, in a world where the population is about to reach, or has already reached, 7 billion, it seems like a much more pressing issue. The true and healthy city that Plato and Socrates yearned for is the same one that local politicians and community organizations are still trying to work out. So I asked Sarah if her research on sex workers led to these questions that she had about the ideal city, because she's moving away from the way people are represented to questions about how these images of them are part of our greater image of the place we think we want to live in.
And it's weird because I get into these conversations with people where I start to tell them things that I'm interested in, and it has been like the internet and like pictures of robots and videos of squids and all sorts of really weird and strange things, and this look of just utter disappointment on their faces when they realize that it's not always all about prostitution, which can be a bit sad for me and a bit mm-hmm. difficult to manage, because on the other hand, I'm never going to drop it. But in some ways, some of the similar themes, yeah. So I'm really interested in how cities and communities get together and tell stories about what the space they live in is like. Mm-hmm. One of the projects I'm working on right now is about these huge narratives about the city, about the shining city that's perfect and the site of everlasting good, that we, when we tell these stories about economic revitalization and gentrification, that we have this vision in our head that this is the kind of city we're working towards. And then at the same time, we construct a vision of the city that we're living in. And we talk about how sinful it is. We talk about urban decay, how there's nobody there, that it's empty and sort of a ghost town, and create this image of a very dirty, diseased, sinful, a city you wouldn't ever want to live in, but apparently we all do, and how these two narratives are employed and played against each other to try to coerce people into doing things like joining those neighborhood associations that would push prostitutes out, but who would also not be very supportive to migrant workers, or who would try to push homeless people out of their neighborhoods, or who would like something like Insight in Vancouver, which just
right
had that landmark case where it can stay open, where people wouldn't be interested in that kind of evidence-based harm reduction because it plays into the wrong narrative about what their city's going to be like.
And we're seeing a lot of that even with the recent elections in Toronto, right? In both the city of Toronto and the province of Ontario, and to a lesser extent what's been going on here in Alberta with the election of a new premier within the party. Mm-hmm. All this talk about what we want to see our city to look like, and not a whole lot of ideas about what it could be, just what we think this ideal image should be.
Yeah, and there's a lot of politics and a lot of power that even goes into deciding what the ideal is, because it's a lot of times it's a really technologically advanced ideal. It's very clean, very sanitized, so there's no one out there making the case that people using drugs in the city would be ideal. That, you know, if everybody was high and happy, that would be great. We'd all get along better. So even the limits of what can be considered the everlasting good of the city are really structured by it, based on who's in power and who has power, and then how power works.
So the final question for Sarah was whether her research on sex workers led to the work that she's doing now on the ideal city, or if she was thinking about the ideal city first. What came first? Sex in the ideal city, or the ideal city and its sex? Was the work on sex workers the chicken or the egg?
It's a bit of a chicken egg situation, but sort of, yeah. So both of these projects came out of some work I did in the city where I used to live, when an artist had taken these kinds of images of sex workers, or women he claimed were sex workers, because he had put up cameras on the roof of his building and just snapped a picture of any woman who happened to stand on the corner for too long.
Oh, great.
That was nice, isn't it? which is weird. We don't think of ourselves as that kind of culture, but this is what happens to women who go out in public without men.
Right.
So any kind of feminist, regardless of whether or not you're deeply concerned with poverty or with labor issues, has a reason to be really concerned about this kind of image. And he took these pictures and he publicized them. He put them up in an art gallery as part of his neighborhood association's push, I think, to get like some zoning law changed or some just like petty bullshit. But using these women's bodies as tools in his petty bullshit. And it got really nasty. There's a petition circulated that said something like, get the prostitutes and drug dealers out, and people put signs up on their windows, and it was like, if that was your working environment and where you lived and where you were trying to raise your kids and you were a sex worker or a drug user, it was just a nasty, hostile environment. So I got a really close, intense, long, firsthand look at how nasty both of these kinds of politics can be. One of the big focuses of my research was to try to take this really complex analysis of what images like this do to the women who are the focus of them, or the subjects of the photographs, and try to put it in accessible terms and try to make it something that people can understand when I say, you know, when you spread the picture around you're doing harm, I want them to know what I mean. And not just that it's not an accurate image, but that there are human beings behind it who have culture's ideas of what their working conditions should be like imposed on them in really dangerous ways. So what was found was that when these neighborhood associations are successful, and in the city where I lived, they never really got organized enough to be successful in pushing women anywhere. But in Vancouver, they were very successful and pushed women from, and men sex workers and trans sex workers. My research focuses on women, but it's not an all-female population, and pushed them from the residential neighborhoods where they lived to the industrial neighborhoods where there was no one to really see what was happening. And at the same time that this really successful displacement campaign was going on, the criminal code was stiffened. So instead of pressing and persistent solicitation being required to grab folks up and put them in jail, then all they needed to do was communicate in public about anything, about condom use, about their rates, about what they would or wouldn't do. So this increased criminalization on top of the displacement. And people started dying, or disappearing, or in various ways just not coming back. And the inquiry of the police is still going on in Vancouver, and they're still ignoring women's voices there. But their perfect city didn't really come out of this, because it's, when you think about the downtown east side in Vancouver you have these murders.
That's all the time we have for today. Music for today's episode was by Ergo Fismes, Lullaby for a Sinking Submarine. You can find this track and others by Ergo Fismes online at the Free Music Archive, freemusicarchive.org. Today's episode was produced with support from the MCAS Station, a landing group dedicated to the development of multimedia podcasts. Also thanks to Sarah. You can find her online at the landing or in the library. When she's not thinking about ways to make the places we live better, she's thinking about this.
The internet and like pictures of robots and videos of squids and all sorts of really weird and strange things.
Thanks again for listening. And remember, we're still looking for suggestions for an official name for the Unofficial Landing Podcast. If you have show ideas or suggestions for people you'd like us to interview, or if you'd like to be on the podcast, come and join the discussion at the Unofficial Landing Podcast group on the landing, or send an email to landingpodcast@gmail.com. The Unofficial Landing Podcast is not officially affiliated with the landing or Athabasca University. The views are expressed are our own. Until next time, I'm Heather Clitheroe, back soon with more stories from the landing.